Part 2, Chapter 5, In Which the Future is Destroyed. Mahogany was asleep when Harvey looked into the room and, not wanting to wake him, Harvey flopped down in a recliner in the adjoining study. Immediately, he was overcome with the personality of the chamber. Every object in it reflected the character of its owner. The guitars, the roll-top desk, the couch that was perfectly situated at the center of the surround sound stereo, and the shelves and shelves of books. From the walls, Harvey was scrutinized by a collection of black-and-white photographs by Sid Nosavad, and a variety of knick-knacks from Mexico, Asia, and Western Europe reflected the different selves within him. One object in particular, a 16th-century Spanish morning star, demanded Harvey's attention. "Arrgh!" he said, swinging the spiked metal ball and smashing the overhead light. Fortunately, there were many candles, and in no time he had one lit. In the flickering light, Harvey noticed a stack of papers on the writer's desk, and he sat to read them. They were the second draft of Part 3 of The Adventures of Captain Harvey. Suddenly, Harvey was overcome by a sense of power. Going about his daily life, he could only be a character in his story, living wherever and however the author chose, but now he could create his world himself. Harvey picked up a pen and set to the task. Unfortunately, the writing was not easy. Each word had to be worked and reworked, and still it was not right. Harvey spent 2 hours editing his first sentence, then pushed his efforts aside and leaned back in the chair. He picked up R.T.'s draft and began to read, and was immediately transported to 1979 and a place called the Treehouse Lounge. The passage recounted the day R.T. and his friends moved into their second-floor apartment. "Argh!" growled Prometheus. "It's like a dull ache," said Hesiod. "A dull ache," echoed Anaximenes. "No, it's like this," said Thales, leaping over a chair in the middle of the room, catching his foot and tumbling to the floor. "Oops," he said. "JD&B," said Epicurus. "JD&B." Another friend arrived with a shopping cart full of beer, and the group scrambled for the refreshments and finished them in a trice. "Hey!" yelled Tithonus, lifting up the cart and throwing it off the porch. It crashed on the rocks below. He rushed to retrieve it and throw it off again, and soon the whole group was setting the cart in flight. Finally, they wheeled it into the steep avenue in front of the apartment and let it go. "Whee!" said the cart as it screamed down the street. It felt as if it were flying, sailing upon the bosom of the tar, zipping past the terrified eyes of mortals who paused to watch it pass. At the bottom of the hill, it smashed into a common shrub. "Ouch!" said the shrub. While the party continued, Harvey lingered with the cart. He felt a special kinship with the basket, because it was, after all, not unlike himself. It was empty, pulled around by the people who encountered it, and the bread, broccoli, and ice cream they put into it were not so different from the hopes, joys, and fears people put into him. Eventually, a young boy found the cart and wheeled it back to the market. "Ah," thought Harvey, feeling the warm little hands on his push-bar. When they reached the store, the boy left Harvey to graze with the other carts. But before he could engage them in conversation, a woman invited Harvey to accompany her onto the floor. Harvey quickly became aware of the striking differences of each shopper. Some jerked him crudely from aisle to aisle, pulling his wheels against the grain and bruising his basket on the displays, while others handled him with grace and affection, gauging the dynamics of his changing weight, and he danced with them, pirouetting through the produce, gliding past the pasta, and resting and loading in front of the cold beer. Sometimes Harvey would intentionally swerve in the bakery section and leave a dent in a loaf of Wonder Bread. Other times he would brush against an oncoming cart, and a metallic shiver would rise through his ribs. Finally, tired of being passed from person to person, Harvey put down the draft he was reading and fell asleep. When he awoke, he heard Roland and Mahogany talking in the next room. "What's this?" said Mahogany, picking up a stack of loose papers on an end table. "That's part two of The Adventures of Captain Harvey," said R.T. "Really?" said Mahogany, forgetting for a moment his broken heart. "Brilliant," he said, beginning to read. "The impressionistic realism and nebulous vivacity, the gut-splitting tragedy and tearful jocularity, the inventive plagiarism and age-old originality. Brilliant, simply brilliant. But will it sell?" "I think so," said R.T. "The movie rights for part one paid for this house and brought me fame as Italy's most innovative writer-director. Of course, I was disappointed that the script writers changed the name and bastardized the death scene by letting that ungrateful Laura Antipas turn it into melodrama. Nevertheless, I saved what I could by directing it myself." "Yes, I saw the film in Mantua," said Mahogany, becoming suddenly sad at the remembrance of that magical night with Harvey, Sylvia, and Adelphine. Mahogany continued to browse the pages in his hands and realized, for the first time, that this was not some fairy tale story created on a whim and without impact on reality. It was, rather, his own fate. His own destiny lay in the plagiarized writings of this unconcerned artist. "I should pay more attention to this man's needs," thought Mahogany, "for he has the power to make my journey to recover Adelphine a successful one. With one simple stroke, he might write, 'Mahogany and Adelphine were reunited and lived happily ever after.' Or, annoyed by the pang of an undigested dumpling, he might write something very different." As the days passed, the writer and progeny became fast friends. Harvey was content to imitate R.T. in whatever he did, going so far as to sit down with him and plagiarize his novel as the author was writing it. Mahogany, on the other hand, became engaged in a sort of religious adoration. He showered R.T. with flowers, food, and precious stones. He burned incense before the author's photograph, which he hung Christ-like on the wall, and he reread part one, annotating each chapter and verse. But soon Mahogany's adoration turned to disgust. He began to feel he must be rid of R.T., for he saw that his entire life revolved around pleasing this mythical creature who was depriving him of a life of his own. Mahogany didn't want to be another man's puppet. He wanted to live his own life, to be rewarded for his own actions. He didn't want to be like those pitiful, terrified masses who pray for blessings in an afterlife rather than create them on earth. But the gods were offended by Mahogany's rejection of the ritual of adoration. "What if all mortals began to refuse to make offerings to their gods?" Hera asked her husband. "Our altars would fall into ruin and become besmeared with smuttish time. We must punish him for his insolence. Perhaps a lightning bolt and an apocalyptic fire." "As you wish," said Zeus. Harvey and Mahogany were still in the meadow, imagining their journey down the path not taken, when R.T. took the finished manuscript of Part Two to the printer's shop in Corfu. The printer was busy at work. "Ah, Mr. Twelves," he said, extending his right hand to the author and ashing his cigarette with his left. "How is Greece's most famous Italian movie director?" R.T. watched the glowing ash of the cigarette as it fell to the floor and smoldered in the grease and fluids. He snuffed it out with the toe of his shoe. "Very well, George. And you?"
"Fine, fine, Mr. Twelves."
"I have brought you the second part of my novel," said R.T., handing him the manuscript. "I trust it can be printed under the same terms as the first."
"Yes, yes, of course," said George. "You are a famous writer now. We will be rich, no matter how bad it is."
"Thank you, George," said R.T., snuffing out another ash. "Be careful with this copy. It's the only one I have."
"Yes, yes, Mr. Twelves," said George, waving the cigarette in his hand.
R.T. decided to go for a hike and walked into the hills above town. In a small pasture, he found two men napping, and they awoke when he approached.
"Hi," said Mahogany.
"Hi," said R.T. "I'm Mahogany Edwards, and this is Jackson Harvey," said Mahogany.
"Roland Twelves, at your service."
"Roland Twelves?" gasped Mahogany. "The famous movie director?"
"Why, yes," said R.T. "Did you see The Raven?"
"I saw it in Mantua," said Mahogany, becoming suddenly sad at the remembrance of that magical night with Harvey, Sylvia, and Adelphine. "It was brilliant."
"Thank you," said R.T. "You're very kind. Are you waiting for someone?"
"No, not really," said Mahogany. "Actually, we were..."
Just then, Mahogany was interrupted by a deafening explosion in the town, and the three men turned to see a black plume of smoke rise into the air. It was the print shop.
"The printers!" screamed R.T., rushing down the hill. Harvey and Mahogany followed and watched with amazement as Roland charged into the flaming shop. Minutes later, when the firemen pulled him out, his hair was smoking and his eyes were burned shut. Sobbing wildly, R.T. threw himself to the ground, buried his head in the sand, and wept dry, waterless tears. In a final explosion, the shop, with the only copy of R.T.'s manuscript, swirled into the oblivion of the sky.
"My world is destroyed," cried R.T. "10 years of labor, and the second part of that most mortal of masterpieces is gone. It will have to be rewritten. The future will never be the same." They took R.T. to a doctor, who bound his wounds and reassured our heroes that, in a few months, his eyesight would return and he would be as healthy as before. He mentioned that the author, after he had been bandaged, had asked the doctor to draw a circle on his chest around his heart, and he warned Harvey and Mahogany to take good care of their friend. Though unfamiliar with the terrain, Harvey and Mahogany managed to get R.T. to his home in Paleokistritsa and put him to bed. It had been a very long day since their arrival that morning on the island, and they fell asleep as soon as they hit the pillow. 2 hours later, they were awakened by the sound of a gunshot, and they rushed into Roland's room and found him weeping on his bed. R.T. had tried to shoot himself in the spot the doctor had marked, but because of his blindness, he had missed. Harvey and Mahogany took Roland back to their room and kept him with them for the rest of the night. The next day, R.T. went to his study, but did not write. Nor did he write the day after, nor the day after that. As a result, Harvey and Mahogany, with their future destroyed, disappeared in the whiteness of the page. Page 104. Page 105. Page 106. Finally, after several weeks, Roland began to rewrite the lost chapters. Due to his blindness, he could not write them himself, so he hired a Greek boy to transcribe the work as he dictated it.
The youth had learned English from the tourists that visited the island, and though his spieling was atrocious, his help was indispensable. R.T. promised to send Harvey and Mahogany a copy of Part Two as soon as he finished it. "How will you know where we are?" said Mahogany. "I will know," said Roland. With their friend in good hands and their history progressing smoothly, Harvey and Mahogany decided to continue on their way. Unfortunately, when they returned to the harbor, they could not find their ship, for a group of Italian drug smugglers working for Oliver North had commandeered it in an attempt to move into the drug market in Western Europe. The attempt had failed when Earth Encycling Poseidon, angered that anyone should steal the captain's ship, turned it to stone as it was sailing past the bay of Calicchiopolo. The locals had already named it Mouse Island.
"What now?" said Mahogany.
"Two piña coladas," called Harvey to a waiter at a restaurant above the beach. They sat, relaxing and drinking, until a rickety fishing vessel coasted up to the shore. The skipper, instead of offering a hand, cried out,
"Lasciate ogni speranza, voi ch'imbarcate."
Footnote. See Charon's warning to Dante, Inferno, Canto 3, line 9. "Give up all hope, ye who embark." Maneuvering his dark boat toward the bank, he shooed out those who were sitting on the benches, cleared the gangways, and straightaway took the bulk of Harvey and Mahogany on board. "I come to take you to the other bank," Charon said, "into the eternal shades of fire and frost."
"We'd rather go to Lefkas," said Harvey.
"Lefkas?" said Charon. "Oh, that's different. That'll be 1,400 drachma." As they made their way to sea, they looked back at the tourists that had gathered for the ferry to Brindisi. "And thus they depart," said the skipper, "those who assemble here from every land, and before they have reached the other side, a fresh crowd gathers again on this."
"Arrgh," said Harvey, growling at the crowd.